From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Tuesday was another day of airstrikes and shelling by Russian-backed Syrian forces in rebel-held eastern Ghouta near Damascus. Amateur video showed rescuers dashing toward heavily damaged areas to help the hundreds of wounded. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said more than 60 were killed on top of Monday's death toll of around 30. The observatory also reported rebel missile strikes targeting the capital. Airstrikes also struck rebel-held northwest Idlib province. The UN Tuesday called for an immediate one-month humanitarian ceasefire in contested parts of Syria. Jens Lerke is with the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs.
They're calling for at least 1 month humanitarian pause starting immediately throughout Syria, given the very critical humanitarian needs and the inability to provide the aid that we do have. The team there, they warns of very dire consequences of the crisis in several parts of the country.
And the lead investigator of a UN-mandated commission of inquiry on Syria said his team is looking into reports of the use of chlorine gas in both Idlib and eastern Ghouta. It appears that embattled South African President Jacob Zuma is approaching the end of his political career as the ruling African National Congress meets this week to discuss his future. Jesse Duarte is an ANC Deputy Secretary General.
So we'll be discussing a matter of serious concern to all of us within the ANC, and of course a matter of great public interest to the people of South Africa. And that's what we're going to do on Wednesday.
75-year-old Zuma has been beset by years of corruption allegations. He was removed as ANC leader in December. His term is due to expire next year. This is VOA News. 81-year-old Iranian-American Bakir Namazi is back in a Tehran jail after a brief medical leave. U.S. spokesperson Heather Nauert expressed disappointment at the news.
We have been alarmed for some time at his declining health. We know that he's in urgent need of sustained medical care. We're deeply disappointed in the fact that he has been returned to prison. We're concerned about his health. We call for his unconditional release from his unjust detention in Iran, and that renews our calling for all Americans who are being held in Iran and being held unjustly to be returned to the United States. That includes his son, Simek, and Shenhua Wang, and also Robert Levinson, who's been there for more than a decade.
An Iranian government medical examiner said he should have been granted a three-month leave. Both Bakir and his son were arrested on espionage charges. The remaining members of the Supreme Court in the Indian Ocean Island nation of the Maldives rescinded an earlier order to free imprisoned opposition politicians after President Yameen Abdul Gayoom declared a state of emergency and had two members of the Supreme Court arrested. Exiled former President Mohamed Nasheed has appealed for Indian intervention. Polish President Andrzej Duda Tuesday signed into law a controversial bill that could result in prison time for anyone using the phrase Polish death camps or suggesting the Polish nation or state was complicit in Nazi war crimes. Martin Krieger is a professor of law and social theory at the University of New South Wales.
They make the point, the correct point, that these were purely Nazi camps in which millions of Poles, as well as Polish Jews and other Jews, were killed, and that there was nothing Polish about them except that they were among the victims.
The country's constitutional tribunal is reviewing the new law. The U.S. and Israel have criticized it, saying it limits freedom of speech and academic inquiry. Rescuers are searching for victims of Tuesday's earthquake in Taiwan that collapsed buildings and left at least two dead, more than 200 injured, and dozens missing. The quake measured 6.4 magnitude, striking near the popular tourist city of Hualien. In Washington, the House of Representatives approved another stopgap spending measure to fund the government through March 23rd, with a Thursday deadline looming. The measure goes on to the Senate. President Donald Trump said he favors a shutdown if Congress fails to approve his immigration proposals.
If we don't get rid of these loopholes where killers are allowed to come into our country and continue to kill, if we don't change it, let's have a shutdown. We'll do a shutdown. And it's worth it for our country.
The House version does not contain changes to immigration law. And on Wall Street, a sigh of relief at the closing bell. Monday's sharp drop nearly 1,200 points is history. The benchmark Dow Tuesday gained nearly 570 to close at 24,912. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, February 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The fate of South African President Jacob Zuma hangs in the balance, awaiting the next move by the ruling ANC.
But Zuma is not yet out, but I think he's on the way out. The question is when and how is he going to agree to move out, because he's being pushed out from the African National Congress.
Shadrach Gutu is a professor emeritus of the University of South Africa. South Sudanese protest against U.S. restrictions on arms sales to their country. A new report says politically motivated killings and arrests are on the rise in Burundi. And Morgan Tsvangirai, the founder of Zimbabwe's main opposition MDC party, is in a hospital in South Africa.
Well, Constitution is very clear on what needs to take place if the president becomes incapacitated. The vice president takes over, and within a year, the vice president has to make sure that there's an extraordinary Congress where a new leader is elected.
Dan Moyo is the chairperson of MDC USA branch, and Somaliland issues its fatwa forbidding female genital mutilation. We'll have an analysis. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The fate of South African President Jacob Zuma hangs in the balance, awaiting the next move by the ruling African National Congress Party as pressure mounts for Mr. Zuma to resign. The president faces the prospect of prosecution for 783 counts of corruption as South Africa's prosecuting authority debates whether to reinstate the dismissed charges. On Tuesday, the parliament postponed the annual State of the Nation address just 48 hours before Mr. Zuma was scheduled to deliver it. Also Tuesday, the ANC postponed a much-anticipated executive council meeting. Shadrach Gutu is professor emeritus of the University of South Africa. He says it's only a matter of time before President Zuma is pushed out of the office.
President Zuma is not yet out, but I think he's on the way out. The question is when and how is he going to agree to move out, because he's being pushed out from within the ruling party, the African National Congress. I think they have had enough of him. But he's stubborn and delaying a lot of things, but he can't delay it forever. I think that in the next 2 to 3 days, we shall know whether he's being pushed out completely or whether or not they will give him some time to move out. But he's definitely on the way out.
Professor, what do you think happened after the ruling African National Congress decided that he should go, but now they have postponed the decision? What do you think is happening behind the scenes?
I think for him, he's trying to get a way out where he will not be prosecuted. There are so many cases against him of corruption, money laundering, a whole lot of things which are waiting. There are over 700 charges of criminal actions against him, and I think he's trying to maneuver out of that to get the National Prosecuting Authority and other law enforcement officials should not prosecute him for all of those. But that means that there has to be plea bargaining. In other words, agree that he can be prosecuted for some with the lower punishment, and then he will be able to reveal what is happening. So far, he has indicated that he is not alone in some of the crimes that have been committed. He is warning those who want to remove him. So that is where he is. But he's in the precipice, and I don't think it's going to last for very long, because the ANC need to remove him now if they want the ruling party need to begin to consolidate itself and begin to campaign for next year's election.
If, let's say, President Zuma is successful to negotiate his way out so that he cannot be prosecuted, will it have any impact on the African National Congress, given that there are elections next year?
No, that's why I'm indicating that there ought to be, or he may go for plea bargaining. Plea bargaining doesn't mean that you are totally free. It means that you are held responsible for some of the crimes that you have committed, and you have to come out and indicate which ones, and then the others are dropped. But there's no way in which President Jacob Zuma can escape punishment for the various crimes that he has committed while in office. So it is not one of simply going out free, but it is one of where you negotiate with the prosecuting authorities to indicate which charges you will admit and which ones you ask them to drop. So it is a bargaining process. It is not one of walking out freely. If that were to happen, of course, it will help the African National Congress. But if it were to be given freedom completely, the African National Congress is still going to suffer in the elections which are coming next year.
So what happened that President Zuma was supposed to give the State of the Nation address? Is there a debate that he should not give that State of the Nation speech, or that he should be allowed to give his final State of the Nation speech?
The Speaker of the National Assembly has indicated that it will be announced when the State of the Nation address will be delivered, and who will deliver it. That is now out, because President Jacob Zuma had indicated is the one who is going to deliver it. Now, that is already gone for now, and it does appear that he will not be, or is likely to be, the one who is going to deliver that. That means that there must be a head of state, acting head of state, who may be appointed to the National Assembly, of course, with agreement of the ruling party, which has a clear majority in the National Assembly at the moment and Parliament overall. So I think that is a strong sign that Zuma is on his way out, whether he likes it or not.
Shadrack Guto is Professor Emeritus of the University of South Africa. He was speaking with me from Pretoria, South Africa. A member of Zimbabwe's main opposition movement for democratic change, MDC, says the party's constitution clearly spells out the process of succession in the event its leader becomes incapacitated. Dan Moyo, chair of MDC USA branch, says the vice president would immediately take over, and within a year's time, he would call an election for a new leader to be elected. This comes after Morgan Tsvangirai, founder of the MDC, is said to be ill in South Africa. Mr. Tsvangirai announced in 2016 that he had colon cancer and that he had been getting treatment in South Africa. He was quoted Tuesday in his Twitter feed as saying he was shocked to read that he was in critical condition. Chairman Moyo of MDC USA says the party is saddened by the news of Mr. Tsvangirai's ill health.
What we know so far is probably what most people know at this point, because President Tsvangirai was very open and transparent from the onset when he was diagnosed with this disease. We know that he's being treated in South Africa, and I'm sure as most people who have had experiences with cancer, the patients go through sort of an up and down kind of like a wave where some days they're very low and some days they kind of like look like they're getting better. So it's really very unpredictable. Right now, what we know is that he's still undergoing chemotherapy at the Johannesburg Hospital. We've had of days when he is feeling a little better, and then we've had of days when he's feeling like worse.
Did you say, is he incapacitated, or, I mean, is he able to talk, or is he not able to talk?
The last I heard was that he was able to talk, and he was cognizant of his surroundings, but this is what we heard, like, a few days back, so I can't say that this is the same situation today.
I read something where he put on his Twitter feed that he was shocked to read in the press that he's in a critical condition. Given what you're saying, his condition may be very serious.
Well, it's really hard to tell at this point because, to be honest with you, I don't even know if he is running the Twitter feed himself. So it's hard at this point to decipher which is real and which is not.
The MDC has been for some time now the main opposition in Zimbabwe, with elections scheduled sometimes before July this year. Where do you think the party will be? Because that raises the question of whether preparation had been made by the MDC for succession.
Constitutionally, yes. Our constitution is very clear on what needs to take place if the president becomes incapacitated. The vice president takes over, and within a year, the vice president has to make sure that there's an extraordinary Congress where a new leader is elected. Of course, we have a dilemma because we have elections coming up in a few months. And also, not only that, we now have three vice presidents, even though the other two were not elected. So if we just go by what the constitution of our party says, the elected vice president needs to take over and make sure that we have an extraordinary Congress within the next year. But then the question is, we need a candidate for the elections.
Mr. Moyo, as you mentioned, you have, what, three vice presidents. Given that the MDC was in a coalition with other political parties, is there an infighting within the MDC?
Well, there's clearly juxtapositioning that is going on as people trying to see who's going to succeed Mr. Tsvangirai. But the bottom line is we are a democratic party. We do not conform to imposition of positions on people. We believe in constitutionalism, and therefore that is the only process that is going to be, I guess, allowed by the members of this party. I think if President Tsvangirai feels that he might not be able to run as our candidate, maybe we need to be having that conversation with him so that we can prepare and have it. Right now, he is the one that is our candidate.
Dan Moyo is chairman of Zimbabwe's main opposition movement for democratic change, MDC USA branch. He was speaking with me from Washington, D.C. Today's Wednesday, February 7th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is now 17 and a half minutes past the hour. Hundreds of South Sudanese turned out yesterday in the streets of the capital, Juba, to protest against the U.S. arms restrictions announced last week. Traditional chiefs had mobilized the citizens to turn out for the pro-government demonstration. Wake Simon Wudu reports for VOA in Juba.
Hundreds of youth, women, and chiefs gathered in front of the gated entrance to the UN mission in South Sudan, or UNMISS, to take part in the pro-government demonstration against the U.S. arms restrictions. The protest was led by the South Sudan Council of Chiefs. Chief Tabana Luka read aloud from the petition as it was delivered to the U.S. Embassy.
The decision, unilateral decision by the United States of America, by restricting arms to the government of the Republic of South Sudan, to us as chiefs, we're saying it is a tactics of weakening the government so that the enemies of this country, even if internally or externally, they will find the government is weak so that they will overthrow the government.
The demonstrators marched from Dr. John Garang Mausoleum to the U.S. Embassy and then on to the UNMISS office in Tomping. They carried banners criticizing the U.S. decision to sanction the South Sudan government for continuing to buy weapons. Some read no arms embargo on South Sudan and no for colonization. The Trump administration announced its unilateral arms restrictions on South Sudan on Friday to pressure the South Sudan government to cease hostilities and end a conflict that has left hundreds of thousands of people dead and displaced more than 4 million people, 2 million inside South Sudan and 2 million others as refugees in neighboring countries. Juba immediately recalled its ambassador to the U.S. on Friday after the arms restrictions were announced. The chiefs admit the war continues in South Sudan but condemn the restricted arms sales, saying it threatens the sovereignty of the country.
We are demanding the government of the United States of America to review this decision. Because as people of South Sudan, we are ready to tell America that what you did cannot help in achieving peace in the Republic of South Sudan.
Scores of demonstrators appeared angry as they gathered at the UNMISS gate. Some threw stones at the office structures. Chir Marow, one of the chiefs at the demonstration, says South Sudan is an independent country that has the right to buy any arms it wants.
This thing is not right. South Sudan is a country, and there's no way another country can come and give orders for South Sudan. This is the reason why we as the youth, chiefs and women came out to protest.
Today's protest is an exception to the rule in South Sudan. In December, women leaders were questioned by national security agents for organizing a march for peace. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Authorities in the self-declared Republic of Somaliland on Tuesday issued a religious fatwa banning the practice of female genital mutilation and vowed to punish violators. The fatwa by the Ministry of Religious Affairs allows FGM victims to receive compensation. Tuesday's declaration coincided with the International Day of Zero Tolerance for Female Genital Mutilation. The United Nations says more than 200 million girls and women in 30 countries are currently living with the harmful and dangerous consequences of female genital mutilation. Fatoum Welle, a Somali-American public health expert, says she welcomes the issuance of the fatwa. She, however, said she's concerned about its implementation. She also says female genital mutilation should be banned.
I'm hoping that this is not one of those lines that are being talked about. And there, whether is this fatwa is going to be implemented is a question I have, because, number one, our religion doesn't support female genital cutting, so it should be illegal. We don't need new fatwa. And also, if you do the fatwa, how are you going to implement those rules and regulations again? You can say, but what are the strategies of implementing? For instance, the women or men that do female genital cutting, it's a way of earning income. What are we going to do to train those people so they can have another way of earning their means? Second, what are the Minister of Health is doing? What are collaborations in the healthcare system, the school system? Are there any infrastructure that is in place that would both not only prevent this but also empower women and girls, so then you have a whole community that is organized, that are well-funded, that are regulated very well?
For example, the fatwa promises to compensate any girl who might suffer from this female genital mutilation and to also punish anyone who is responsible for that. But it doesn't say who is going to compensate the girls, whether the government or who.
Well, again, while I say, you know, this fatwa goes forward and says they'll compensate, but again, you can say there are a lot of rules that is being talked about, but it's yet to be seen what are the strategies of implementing. Are you already questioning who? And we don't have the whole picture. Is this just something that they said it and it looks good? You know, we're talking about VOAs, we're talking about it. What is it? And the second thing is, we know for a fact, like our whole life of our team of 9 staff and a small nonprofit, we're both fighting legislation here in Minnesota that are discriminating women and girls and families who have been gone through female genital cutting. There is horrible health risk factors and all that. But I wanted to see not only our country, not only all the African countries, areas that have these practices. I wanted to see this become a priority. It's not there are no, women and girls are not part of the country's priorities. They need their own requirements. They need their own resources. So unless they see a strategy that is with these talk, otherwise this is going to be full of it, I would say.
Somalia is, I see, one of the countries where this FGM is, what I would say, prevalent, but so also with other African countries. How do you think, because there are some people who say, well, this is part of the culture of people. So how do you think, how do you balance that up? And how do you think it can be eradicated?
Well, number one, Somalia is one of the 26 or 28 countries on the contract. And so the eradication of FGC is going to take a lifetime commitment. And that commitment is a commitment of country, commitment of individual community members, individual commitment of the fathers, commitment of the brothers, and commitment for grandma and grandpa. And you cannot eradicate FGC until we address the critical social issues that women and girls suffered. The lowest education for girls, the lack of upward mobility, of poverty of women and girls and families overall. Unless we address these systematic issues that make girls who are in these countries in poverty and lack of opportunities, we cannot eradicate female genital cutting.
Fatoum Wele is a Somali-American public health expert. She was speaking with me from the Midwestern U.S. city of Minneapolis. In Burundi, more than 500 people have been killed in the past year, most of them by the ruling party youth wing and security forces, according to a recent report from a Burundian human rights group. As Mohamed Yusuf reports for VOA from Nairobi, the allegations have raised concern as Burundi heads towards a contentious referendum.
The report titled Do Not Play With Fire documents the killings, disappearances and torture in the hands of Burundi's security agencies and the ruling party youth wing, the Imbonerakure. According to the investigators, more than 500 people were killed in Burundi in 2017 and more than 10,000 are behind bars. Pierre Clevin Bonimba is the head of the Association for the Protection of Human Rights and Detained Persons. All the cases we documented, those people died at the hands of military, police or Imbonerakure. Some of them were accused of practicing witchcraft and some were killed on land-related issues. The rights group notes all the allegations were fabricated and believe these people were killed because of their political affiliations. Bonimba, who is living in exile, says the human rights situation in Burundi is getting worse. Since I began following prisoners' rights, I have never seen more than 11,800 prisoners in Burundian prisons. It is very sad and shameful. The prison can only host 4,050 individuals. They live in squalid conditions. Many of them are political prisoners. For us, we say that human rights violation now is on a very high level in Burundi. Burundi's minister in charge of human rights, Martin Nevibandi, refused the allegation in the report. No country is a paradise in the world. People die. But saying that the situation got worse into 2017, while what we have in our reports shows improvements, it surprises us so much. It's what we always say, people do not know how to separate politics and activism. They mix contesting the power and human rights actions. In all their reports, they want to show security forces are involved in human rights violations. According to the UN Refugee Agency, more than 430,000 Burundians have fled the country since 2015, when President Pierre Nkurunziza ran for a controversial third term. Most of the refugees cite human rights abuses, continued political uncertainty and humanitarian crisis as a reason for fleeing. In December, Burundi's government proposed constitutional changes that would, among other things, allow Nkurunziza to stay in office beyond 2020. The referendum on the proposal takes place in May. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that's it for this Wednesday, February 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Botti in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good Wednesday.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clott, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, political tensions simmer in Kenya as opposition leader Raila Odinga takes a symbolic presidential oath of office as the people's president, despite warnings from the nation's attorney general, who called the mock swearing-in of Odinga an act of treason. An in-depth look at Kenya's political future on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.